What's up, horror fans? Say no to drugs and stay out of the basement. You're listening.
We interrupt our program to bring you
Final Girl Friday.
Welcome to Final Girl Friday. My name is Molly, and I like scary movies. Tonight, I'll be taking a long look at one of my personal favorite summertime slasher films, Sleepaway Camp, from 1983. I'll also be announcing the winner of the Sleepaway Camp swag bag giveaway to wrap up May's B-Movie of the Month. That announcement, along with this deep dive, have been insanely delayed, and I sincerely appreciate everyone's patience. I can't speak for you guys. I cannot speak for anyone other than myself, but I have no doubt many of you will agree with me that this month has fucking sucked. This year has fucking sucked. It's been one long, exhausting catastrophe after another with no end in sight. It's been all but impossible to stay positive. And I didn't want to just sit down here and try to pretend that it isn't happening, that I haven't had the shit kicked out of me, so to speak, by the pandemic, by the realization of how far we have yet to go regarding the eradication of racism in the United States, by finally starting to see some value in cancel culture, which up to this point I have been staunchly against. And that in and of itself has been a bit of a mind fuck for me, trying to reconcile my own principles as a human being, my own ethics, with the necessity of drawing hard lines for the sake of growth moving forward. In my personal life, admittedly, part of a much smaller picture, I'm angry that I now feel compelled to go back and remove the news and reviews I recorded to promote and support Slaver Day, as the project is dead because people refuse to own their shit and it's damaging the people around them. I was also quite sick for a while with some kind of upper respiratory infection, and while I was recovering from that, a very dear friend of mine died. So suffice it to say, I needed some time. I needed to take a little time to let my body mend, to clear my head as much as it can be cleared right now, to organize my thoughts so that I could allow myself a few moments to be exhausted here, to acknowledge everything that I am feeling and to allow it to breathe before jumping into what will otherwise be your average everyday Final Girl Friday episode, because that's ultimately what my brain needs right now. I hate that racism exists. I hate that so much of the fight against systemic racism in America has been met by excessive force. I hate that I woke up to reports last week of Black men being hanged from trees in Southern California. I hate that that sentence just came out of my mouth. I hate that I'm getting phone calls from friends in tears who were shot with rubber bullets and tear gas during peaceful protests, and that my agoraphobic ass is just sitting up here in my studio trying to combat the problem by blacking out my fucking Facebook profile picture as if that will accomplish anything. I hate that I am getting so upset by feeling helpless, as this is not about me, and I know that, but knowing it doesn't make me feel any better, and that just starts the cycle all over again. And I hate that it's so hard to see and focus on some of the good that is coming out of this. And there are good changes coming out of it. It's just, it's hard to see them. I know you guys don't come here for this. You come here for horror movies. I know that's why I come here. I want to talk about Sleepaway Camp. I want to celebrate it and my patrons and the giveaway. I want to talk about horror news. I want to do all the things I come here to do. It's just, as I said, I didn't want to just step over what's been happening. I've tried recording this episode several times over the course of the last couple of weeks without this, and it felt gross. I felt gross. I mean, that's partly why it's taken so long to get it done. And I don't have any answers, obviously, but I do know two things. Firstly, that my heart goes out to everyone fighting the good fight right now, be it for Black Lives Matter or the medical professionals continuing to keep us alive and well during the pandemic, or those of you who are being treated now as though you were complicit in the deception of Slaver Day's forerunner when in truth you had absolutely no idea what he had done. You all have my support, for whatever that support is worth. I cannot help feeling like anything that I could say or do is not good enough. And that's stupid. That's a stupid way to feel. Every way in which we can, as individuals, fight these fights, it's contributory. Secondly, I am so grateful for all of you who have taken time out of your lives, brief moments away from your anger and what you're going through, to send love and well wishes my way in the wake of Josh's death. Thank you guys so much for that. It has been so nice to feel surrounded by incredibly kind and loving people, especially because most of the time I feel I am otherwise surrounded by quite the opposite. Thank you for allowing me the time and the freedom to grieve and also to be angry, to be exhausted, and thank you for listening to me. I really hope we make it out of this year alive, and I hope we come out the other end better people. That's my hope. All right, so to kick off what from here on out will be just another episode of Final Girl Friday, I am thrilled to finally be announcing that the winner of the Sleepaway Camp swag bag giveaway is... Notch. Congratulations, Notch. You have won a Tales from the Waterfront comic book style poster and Death by Curling Iron enamel pin from Terror Threads, as well as a special collector's edition Blu-ray of Sleepaway Camp and a limited edition postcard featuring original Final Girl Friday artwork from Braindeet. I hope you enjoy that as well. I'd like to thank everyone who participated in this giveaway. Thank you so much for being a part of it. And I'd like to thank my patrons, Xerxes, Eli, Mel, Alan, and Susie Q. Thank you guys so much for continuing to pledge to my Patreon and fund giveaways like this one. I'm feeling very emotional right now, if it's not obvious. So thanks, Notch. Thanks, everybody on Slasher. Thanks, everyone on the Discord. Just thanks. Thank you guys for being decent human beings. I do have a couple of points of interest in horror news that I would like to touch down on. I use the word news a little loosely here. When I first made my preliminary notes for this episode, which was several weeks ago, this was all new information. It isn't so much anymore, but I wanted to go ahead and relay the information anyway in case it has gone overlooked. First and foremost, we will be getting a new Evil Dead movie. Not a remake, not a reboot, a new film. That's a headline I would like to see more of in the future. That's the kind of news I like to wake up to. There are three things we know for sure about the new Evil Dead. One, it will be written and directed by Lee Cronin, director of The Hole in the Ground from 2019, which is available on Amazon Prime right now, and I watched it for the first time yesterday. It is fantastic. I thought it had a great script, definitely a wonderful score by Stephen McKeon. My God, I love the music for the film. It was a creepy little story, and I thought it was told very well, so that makes me hopeful. Also, the fact that Cronin isn't a director I'm super familiar with. He doesn't have a lot of notches in his belt, and that gives me hope as well. Maybe that makes me a hipster. I don't know, but I would much rather see a kind of up-and-coming director tackle this project. Number two, the film will be called Evil Dead Now. Not the most exciting title, but I'm not going to dwell on it. And number three, Bruce Campbell will not be reprising his role as Ash, but rather we will have a female protagonist. I don't know anything else about her other than that she is female. And this does seem to be the most disappointing detail for a lot of fans. Not that we'll have a female in the lead, but that Ash won't be coming back. And I get why people are let down by that. But I also agree with some of the reactions I've been seeing in favor of the news that we've had three wonderful movies with Ash in the lead, not to mention Ash vs. Evil Dead, which was a big success. And I think it's okay to let Ash go out on a good note. Let him retire in peace. There are so many stories potential in the Evil Dead universe. There's so much you can do with the Deadites, the Necronomicon. At this point, I choose to be excited at the prospect of a brand new story. We'll see how it goes. Moving on from film to horror gaming, and this definitely falls into old news territory. But when I first made the note to talk about it, it had just happened, and it's a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal to me. A few of you out there listening found this podcast and met me through YouTube, where I used to stream Dead by Daylight every day. That's a thing that I did for a long time. And those of you who knew me there also know that I will never, ever do it again. I loved the community we built over there. I did, but I burned out on DBD so hard, harder than I've ever burned out on anything in my life. And I was warned about burnout from some of my fellow YouTube friends, and I just brushed it off like, It'll never happen to me, which turned out to be utter bullshit in the end because, yeah, I burned out super hard. But a few weeks ago, during their anniversary live stream, the devs from Dead by Daylight made an announcement so epic, it completely revived my enthusiasm for the game, and I've slowly started picking it back up. I won't be live streaming my gameplay, but it does feel good to be excited about Dead by Daylight again. If you're not familiar with Dead by Daylight, it's a 1v4 survival horror game where one player is a killer hunting four survivors in a vicious cycle of death and more death, all overseen by a mysterious entity. Among other things, the game is known for bringing familiar faces from the horror genre into its fold, like Leatherface, Freddy Krueger, the Demogorgon, as well as beloved survivors like Ash Williams, Detective Tapp, and Laurie Strode. And now they've added a legendary killer from one of the most beloved and elusive IPs in gaming's history, Silent Hill's Pyramid Head. He is accompanied by survivor Cheryl Mason and a map of Midwich Elementary School. Not only is this just ridiculously cool, but Dave Richards' face when he was going into more detail about it after the trailer was just, it was the stuff of pure joy. And if Pyramid Head isn't enough, which he should be, players who own the PC version of the game and the Silent Hill DLC can now use the Konami code on the main menu to unlock a special version of the DBD theme song that is so fabulous, as well as the Vic Viper charm for their characters. I am so pleased by this. Considering how much so many of us miss Silent Hill and how heartbroken we all still are over PT, being able to explore a game, any game, with official elements from the Silent Hill universe in any kind of a new way is a truly satisfying experience. For a little recommended reading, there is a great editorial by Julianne Stipitis at Bloody Disgusting called Slice and Dice, How Post-Pandemic Horror Could Lead to the Next Golden Age of Slashers. I really enjoyed this particular piece, which, among other things, examines and draws parallels between the Reagan-era tropes we've come to know so well through the subgenre and the world in which we're living today. And then over at Dread Central, we have the expertly timed Scares That Soothe, Top 10 Happy Ending Feel-Good Horror Movies by Editor-in-Chief Josh Milliken. This list includes The People Under the Stairs, Warm Bodies, Let the Right One In. It's a great collection of films that I think a lot of us really need right now. Lastly, heading over to YouTube, if you have not checked out Ben and his channel Cadaver Club, I highly recommend it. He was recently named HorrorTuber of the Month, which I feel like he completely deserves. He's just a really fun, warm horror fan with excellent taste, who has done some pretty fantastic reviews and also hosted some fun like group chats with fellow horror fans and content creators. His channel has been a source of calm for me lately, and I want to just spread the love of it wherever I go. So if you haven't checked out Cadaver Club on YouTube yet, please do. He's fantastic. All right, I think that's all I've got for now, so it's time to dive into the movie. Be sure to check out some of my favorite sites like Bloody Disgusting, Dread Central, Horror News Network, iHorror.com for tons of horror-centric info from people far more on top of the news than I am. And as usual, if you haven't seen Sleepaway Camp from 1983, proceed with caution because I am about to spoil the entire film for you. Okay, so Sleepaway Camp, written and directed by Robert Hiltzik, released on November 18th, 1983. I first saw this film when I was 19 years old, during one of the more memorable summers of my life, when my best friend Lauren and I spent nearly every weekend binging stacks of movies we picked up, primarily from this little family-owned video store in my hometown called All Star Video. Oftentimes, we would choose these movies based solely on their ridiculous or bizarre cover art, but Sleepaway Camp was a direct recommendation from Lauren, as it was the most shocking movie that she had ever seen, and she couldn't believe I had never seen it. And I had such a great time watching it with her that day. I will never forget it. I have a terrible memory, but certain events, of course, are just burned into my brain, and seeing Sleepaway Camp with Lauren for the first time is just one of those memories. And she certainly wasn't wrong about it being shocking. Like a lot of people, the first time that I saw this film, I was thoroughly unprepared for the ending, and it stuck with me forever. And I remember Lauren's face too, like, I'm watching the ending, my brain is piecing together what I'm seeing, and I look to her, and she is just not even watching the movie, she is eyes locked on me with this giant grin on her face. She just could not wait for me to react to the ending. It was a great time. And back then, Sleepaway Camp was still a relatively unsung horror film. It was obscure, and that has changed dramatically over the course of the last like 20 years. A lot of people are aware of it now. A lot of people love it now. And it's being celebrated as well as studied for a variety of reasons. Something I hear often said lately, which I agree with, is that it feels a little unfair to focus solely on the shocking ending of Sleepaway Camp. It isn't just a cheesy camp slasher movie with a twist. And I understand that now. It's a genuinely unique and enjoyable film through and through that raises a lot of questions and has certainly stirred up some controversy, which I will address. I do not feel in any way qualified to weigh in on the discussion of transgender representation in horror films in general and in this film specifically. I'm not qualified. I do have a couple of recommendations for podcasts and YouTube videos that I feel have asked and explored that question quite well, definitely much better than I could. And I will provide information regarding those podcasts and videos at the end. Also, on a personal note, two issues tackled by this film pretty much from start to finish are that of sexual violence and bullying, particularly the latter. I personally feel that Sleepaway Camp acts as a cautionary tale, warning against bullying, against sexual violence. I have always felt that way, and watching it again now, I still feel that way. That has never changed. I don't feel that it is an exploitative film. I feel that it is a warm-hearted film that is advocating for the children in it who have been victimized. Granted, I am also not inherently opposed to exploitation film as an art form, and I wholeheartedly believe that it is vital for us to be able to directly confront and converse with things that make us uncomfortable. But I'm also mindful of the ongoing discussion happening right now regarding how certain people and certain types of violence are represented and explored in the media. It's an important discussion to have if things are going to continue to change for the better, and I try to bear that in mind when examining films that are absolutely a part of that discussion. One disadvantage I think that Sleepaway Camp still has is that it's easy for people who haven't seen it to assume it's just a ripoff of Friday the 13th. And that, to me, is a tragedy because I don't prefer Sleepaway Camp to Friday the 13th, but I would put them on a par with one another. I'd say I like them equally in different ways. And they're two very different films. Yes, they're both set in a summer camp. And yes, someone is murdering people at that camp, but that's really where most of their similarities end. In Friday, for example, you have camp counselors being killed by an angry mother during the off season. In Sleepaway Camp, it's kids being killed while the camp is operational. In Friday the 13th, there's quite a bit of that sex, drugs, and free love kind of feel, whereas with Sleepaway Camp, it's water balloon fights and dances in the rec hall. And instead of a creepy drifter warning everyone around him of doom and gloom, you have a wackadoo camp director who spends most of the movie kind of living inside of his own head, playing detective, dead convinced that the killer is a young boy hell-bent on ruining his life. I am such a fan of that side plot, by the way. I absolutely love the evolution of Mel's paranoia regarding Ricky and how that plays out alongside the main story. One of the other things that I personally find most fascinating about this film is that much like Prom Night, it creates a provocative divide between the villain or the villains of the story and our killer. With 1.5 notable exceptions that I'll explore as I go on, the killer at Camp Arawak targets garbage people, and a good case can be made against the equally terrible people responsible for what's going on in the killer's psyche in the first place. Sleepaway Camp tells the story of Angela Baker, a shy 13-year-old girl whose family was killed in a boating accident when she was very young. Shortly thereafter, she is taken in by her Aunt Martha, who kind of keeps Angela tucked away in the house for many years before finally letting her out into the world for summer camp. It's there where we learn the answers to questions we never knew we had, like, how does one make pedophilia more gross? And can you kill a girl by impaling her through the bajango with a curling iron? Sleepaway Camp was, as I mentioned, written and directed by Robert Hiltzik, who has essentially only really worked on the Sleepaway Camp films. The same is true of Jerry Silva and Michelle Titojan, also the casting director, who produced Sleepaway Camps 1 through 3. The film was shot on a budget of $350,000 in October of 1982. It has this great late summer, early fall feel to it that just does it for me. SFX makeup for Sleepaway Camp was done in part by Ed French, who worked on The Stuff, Creepshow 2, and I was excited to learn that he also did makeup for an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Zeppo, where Xander becomes an unwitting member of a gang of zombies, whose makeup was, to my memory, really good. I don't actually know for certain that that French was directly responsible for the zombie makeup. If he was, it makes sense. I really enjoy the SFX in Sleepaway Camp. I'm also particularly fond of the hairstyles and costumes in this film, the latter being done by Eileen Seif, who worked on Creepshow and Day of the Dead. I am such a big fan of the wardrobe, and perhaps most notably, my favorite thing about this movie is the score. And I know I'm gonna fuck this guy's name up. The score was composed by Edward Bilouse. It was his debut film as a credited composer, and it is one of my favorite scores of the 1980s. The film opens with some beautiful shots of Camp Arawak and the surrounding lake set to, as I mentioned, some truly epic orchestral music, layered with audio clips of kids chanting and generally having a good time. We also see the Camp Arawak sign with a big for sale sign slapped over it, which works really well in providing a bit of context for the audio we're hearing. I get the impression that what I'm listening to are the echoes of all of the campers that have come before, and I really appreciate the tone that sets. Once the credits are over, we are introduced to a small family. John, well outfitted with some epic chest hair and khaki short shorts, he and his two small children, Peter and Angela, around 4 and 5 years old, respectively, are hanging out on this little boat close to the lakeshore of Camp Arawak. With them as well, though not in the boat, is a man named Lenny, whose relationship with John we learn a little bit more about later. While they are lounging in the sun, the kids are kind of bickering, being generally adorable. Behind them, a little further out on the lake, is a speedboat. And in this speedboat are two teenagers, a lifeguard of some kind, and a young pile of human garbage named Marianne. Attached to that boat is another teenage girl who is water skiing and seems to be having the worst time of her entire life. She is screaming for them to stop the boat so that she can stop water skiing. She hates it. But Marianne does not give a fuck because she wants to drive the speedboat. She is peer pressuring this lifeguard into letting her drive. She's also, I'm convinced, practically blind, as she remarks that no one will see them way out here. Quote, "It's a pretty small lake that's very crowded, so I don't know what she means by way out here. I think she just has like no depth perception." And once he finally succumbs and lets her drive the boat, she aims it directly at the shore and drives at full speed into this poor family. The father and one of the children are killed, although we don't actually see the body of the child who died. We do see John's body, however, as it's floating face down in the water very slowly across the frame. And we see a life jacket belonging to the child that died kind of bubble and float up to the surface. The girl who was water skiing has now been abandoned in the water and is screaming bloody murder for someone to help this family. Meanwhile, Lenny on shore, who has had to stand here and watch this happen, is devastated. This whole scene, I feel, was shot and edited very well. It almost feels like a bit of a vignette, and it is very powerful. Hats off to Benjamin Davis, who did the cinematography, and Ron Kalish and Sharon Ross, the editing team. It's just, it is a very powerful way to open the film, and you immediately feel awful for everyone involved, except for Marianne. Because what the fuck? We cut to 8 years later, and we're in the home of a woman named Martha, who was the sister of either John or Lenny. I'm really not sure. Two children come down the stairs and into the foyer, and this is where we learn that Angela, played by Felissa Rose, was the child who survived. She's joined by her cousin Ricky, played by Jonathan Tiersten, and the two of them are getting ready to go to camp for the summer. It will be the first time that Angela has really been out in the world since her family was killed, and Martha is very doting on her. She wants to make sure that Angela has everything she could ever possibly need, whatever my little girl wants. She's very concerned, very attentive. And Ricky, who seems to be around Angela's age, is just sort of tuned out to it. You get the impression that this is just always how Martha is. And I'll tell you, it's not just the doting on Angela. Martha is batshit insane. She is one of the most bizarre characters I have ever encountered in a horror film. And that is saying something. Her wardrobe consists mainly of very bold contrasting colors, and her makeup is very much the same. She's a very loud person, both visually and actually. She doesn't really say anything so much as she half sings, half shouts every word that comes out of her mouth. And she seems to drift in and out of reality. She kind of goes away periodically into her mind and talks talks to herself. Desiree Gould, who played Martha, has talked in the past about how she felt then that the Martha role was too weird. The lines were just too out there, and she tried to give the role away to someone else, but Hiltzik told her, no, this is your role. You have to do this. And ultimately, it seems that she appreciated that. I am so glad that role didn't go to anyone else. I feel like Desiree Gould was the perfect person to play Martha. She's a complicated character, and in my personal opinion, I believe that Martha is the true villain of the story. I think that of everyone in Sleepaway Camp, and it is a smorgasbord of villainy. She's like top tier bad guy. And then of course, when they introduce her here, we immediately establish that she is nuts. I don't think she has any clue that she's a bad guy. In the opening scene, John and little Angela had a very brief discussion about Martha, and we got the impression from their conversation that Martha is a doctor. And this is confirmed for us here in the foyer when Martha hands the kids their documentation for the pre-camp physicals that she gave them. But she also tells them not to let anyone at camp know that the physicals were done by her or that the documents came from her. She hands them their lunches and sends them off with another long, worried, and loving look at Angela that just gets more and more disturbing every time I see this film. And then the kids leave. They're off on the bus and headed to Camp Arawak. The buses arrive at camp to one of my personal favorite pieces of music from the film, and out pour scores of children, many of whom were relatives of the cast and crew, which just adds to that air of low-budget family film, you know, that Sleepaway Camp has. The kids are screaming and laughing as they race across the campgrounds, and they are really running, just like wild animals, as soon as they get off that bus, which makes life difficult for Mel, the camp director, played by Mike Kellen, who is yelling at them so angrily to get wherever they're going. I mean, I did go to summer camp as a kid, and then I was a marching band kid, so I went to band camp several times. I don't ever remember there being a particular sense of urgency, ever. Like, we did everything very slowly. Like, take your time. You're at camp. But no, Mel is really pissed that they are late to something. He and a burly camp counselor named Ronnie, who I love, and I love his short shorts. There are so many pairs of short shorts in this movie. I'm pretty sure Ronnie's are my favorite. He is also shouting alongside Mel instructions. I cannot understand them. It's just much too loud, so there's no way that those kids are absorbing the information. They keep trying, though. And Mel has a cigar in his hand through almost this entire movie, by the way, and I love it. As the kids are running through the grounds, we are introduced to the kitchen staff, who are standing outside of the mess hall, aprons all covered in food, smoking and watching everybody arrive. And the head chef quickly establishes himself as the creep to end all creeps as he salivates over the young girls and says out loud to the guys around him that they make his mouth water. He says a few other choice things that I'm just not even going to repeat here. It's deplorable. I mean, we all know that pedophilia is deplorable, but for some reason, Owen Hughes, who played this character's name is Artie. Man, he's a champion pedophile. It's fucking revolting. And none of the staff chime in with like, oh yeah, pedophilia is my jam, but fellow cook Ben, played by none other than the father of James Earl Jones, laughs hysterically and teases him about how the kids are too young to even understand what he's talking about. And then Artie retaliates with equally playful teasing, and it just becomes this like, aw, Artie, that's so cute. You're right. I am too old to appreciate child molestation. Okay, bye. We leave them, thankfully, as Ricky and Angela are met by Paul, one of Ricky's friends who he has known for several years from coming here to camp. Ricky introduces Paul to Angela, who is very non-responsive, and Ricky explains that she's shy, and Paul doesn't seem too hurt by it, mostly because he's more concerned with telling Ricky that this girl Judy has developed like giant boobs since the last time he saw her. Ricky gives Angela a quick tour of the camp until they spot said Judy talking to some very tall older boys. Ricky calls out to her, and we get our first glimpse of the ever fabulous Karen Fields. Judy is one of my absolute favorite characters from any slasher film. I put her right up there with Trent from The New Friday. She has the most spectacular resting bitch face, often accentuated perfectly by classic side ponytails and bright pink somersets. She blows Ricky off with this cocky grin and goes back to the boys, and Ricky's hurt by this. So he goes to talk to her after dropping Angela off at her cabin, but Judy, it seems, has become much too mature for the likes of Ricky and tells him she no longer has time for his nonsense before heading to the girls' cabin. cabin. Once she gets there, we are introduced to Meg, another stellar example of the garbage people I've been mentioning. She's a young camp counselor who makes sure we know that she's a bitch by spelling her name out for the kids and using the word capiche. She introduces another much nicer counselor by the name of Susie, and then everybody just sort of gets settled into the cabin. While everybody's kind of milling about unpacking their stuff, Angela just sits there on her bed and stares at Judy from across the bunks, and it freaks Judy out, which I don't condone anything Judy does. I may love her, and I do, but I mean, she's a horrible human being. She's a terrible child. But Angela's stare is extremely unsettling, and I don't blame her for being weirded out about it, especially because she doesn't stop staring at Judy until Susie comes over to talk to her. Meg goes over to Judy, and the two of them bond over their immediate dislike of this awkward girl, and we fade out to the cafeteria 3 days later. The thing about that stare, too, from Angela is that it essentially, from what I understand, was a big part of why Felissa Rose got the job. She was instructed in her audition to stare intensely and pretend to eat a candy bar. There are so many moments in this film where you can really tell, like, that is exactly how Felissa nailed it, was with that fucking face. It's a very unsettling stare. The cafeteria is packed, and at the head of the room, at a kind of special table, are Mel and Ronnie. Though they never actually say it in exact words, I suspect that Ronnie is, like, the head camp counselor. Meg goes over to the special table, and she and Mel are being very friendly with one another before Mel sends Ronnie over to the table where Angela is sitting. And we realize that Meg was informing them that Angela has not eaten anything since they arrived at camp. Ronnie is super nice to her and asks if it's true that she hasn't been eating, but she doesn't respond. And Meg further explains that Angela hasn't said a word since coming to camp either. Ronnie takes her into the kitchen to see if they can find something she might like to eat, which pisses Meg off as she thinks, you know, they're spoiling her. In the kitchen, Angela is introduced to Artie, who doesn't even try to pretend he isn't a pedophile. He's just checking her out from top to bottom, standing way too close. And going back to what I said about Felissa Rose's face, it's almost completely void of expression throughout most of this movie, and all you get from her here is this frozen, wide-eyed stare that is just perfect. Ronnie asks Artie to find something for Angela to eat, goes to take a phone call, and Artie takes her back into the walk-in where he tries to rape her. Right there in the walk-in, during lunch, while all the other kitchen staff are, like, still working in the kitchen, the middle of the fucking day, he just corners her and starts unbuckling his belt. Interestingly, Felissa Rose wasn't actually present for these types of moments. They used a stand-in. And according to Rose, Owen Hughes was one of the sweetest guys she had ever worked with. I think it's great that with the help of Felissa's mother, they were able to keep her as far away from the sexual violence as possible during filming. I mean, she was 13 years old. And I think that their efforts really shine through when Felissa remembers this movie. Her experiences on the set of Sleepaway Camp all seem to be wonderful ones. Which reminds me, if you haven't seen At the Waterfront After the Social, the Sleepaway Camp documentary, I highly recommend it for Felissa's contributions alone. I mean, it's a great documentary, but God, every time she talks about being in this film and what a fantastic experience it was for her and the legacy that it's left, you know, it makes me very emotional. Back in the cafeteria, Ricky is looking for Angela, and he and Meg have this little exchange about Angela being weird. And this is the first time that we really begin to see just how much Ricky cares for Angela. He never hesitates to defend her, no matter what. He is always on her side. Meg delivers one of the more memorable one-liners here, saying that if Angela were any quieter, she'd be dead. I've always been a big fan of that line. Side note, Judy is at this table, and she's wearing this frilly plaid halter top thing in the scene that is amazing. I know that I mentioned this earlier, but the wardrobe department for Sleepaway Camp. They did such an awesome job dressing everybody in this movie, and they struck gold with Judy. Ricky goes back into the walk-in and inevitably catches Artie being a total creep to yet another excellent piece of tense music, and Artie is for some reason surprised to have been interrupted, and he slams Ricky against some boxes and tells him to keep his mouth shut. In contrast to Felissa Rose's heartwarming memories about filming Sleepaway Camp, Jonathan Tiersten remembers this scene in particular a little differently, as Owen was instructed to really slam him into the shelves and it banged Jonathan up pretty badly. In fact, I remember when James A. Janisse did the kill count for Sleepaway Camp, he mentioned at one point the At the Waterfront documentary and Jonathan Tiersten's contributions to it specifically, and how so many of the people that were involved in Sleepaway Camp seemed to have very fond memories of it, but for some reason, Jonathan Tiersten's memories are really not great. And in that kill count, James A. Janisse is like, I hope you're doing okay, buddy. I never really understood that fully until I watched that documentary. And then I'm like, man, yeah, I really hope he's okay. He just seemed very sad. I really hope it wasn't anything like horribly awful. I hope that if it had to be anything, that maybe he was just not in a great place at the time of the documentary. And I hope he's doing better now. The kids run out of the walk-in and Artie is pissed, walking back out into the kitchen, still buckling his belt, which somehow goes unnoticed by both Ben and Mel. Mel is kind of eyeballing Artie, but he definitely does not notice the belt. There's a weird moment between them, but it isn't a moment that says to me, I know what you were doing back there. It mostly just says, I'm gonna smoke this cigar very pointedly and think about what just happened in a vague and unassuming way. And that's Mel for about the first half of this film. Later on, Ben is shucking corn in the kitchen as Artie checks on the water in the single tallest cooking pot you could ever conceive of. Seriously, this pot has to be at least 4 feet tall. Artie has to use a chair to look down into it. Ben leaves and Artie gets angry at an empty container of salt and goes into the walk-in to get more. And this is where we get our first POV shots. We see Artie going into the walk-in from a short, shaky POV that makes its way into the kitchen and quickly hides behind one of the counters when Artie returns and climbs back up onto the chair to toss about a half a thing of salt into the pot, which probably still isn't enough considering how big it is. The killer creeps around the corner and over to Artie's dirty butt. They could not have made this character any more disgusting, I don't think. His butt is so dirty. The killer then shoves him toward the pot. He catches himself on the shelf above the stove and calls out behind him, first negotiating, then screaming death threats as the killer pulls the chair out from under him. We get two clues here as to the identity of the killer. First, the height of the POV. I have seen films that are mindful of the height of their killer when doing POV, and I've seen films that just seem to disregard it. And I appreciate that Sleepaway Camp took the height of their killer in mind when creating these POV shots. But that's the first clue that we get. And secondly, Artie offers them an ice cream sundae if they help him down. The killer does not, of course, and instead yanks the chair out from under him. He falls flat on his back on the kitchen floor with the pot to end all pots toppling over, spilling gallons of boiling water all over him. The killer flees and we get some really great SFX shots. First of Artie's twisted hands all burned as steam is rising up from beneath them, and then of his face as it blisters and he is just screaming, and it is satisfying. And I'm not saying that we should pour boiling water on pedophiles, but it's a good, long, satisfying scene, you know? That's all I'm saying. After a good long while, Ben re-enters the kitchen, discovers him there, and he is horrified. Artie is still screaming in agony as paramedics, played by actual paramedics, cart him out of the kitchen and away from Camp Arawak forever. The rest of the kitchen staff, Mel, Ronnie, and a doctor who may or may not be the camp doctor, they don't really establish where he comes from. They watch as Artie is taken away. Then the doctor explains that he's badly burned, which every time I hear that line, it cracks me up. Because Mel saunters over to him with his cigar and he's like, what's the prognosis, doc? Even though by this point, Artie has been wrapped from like head to toe in gauze right there in front of them. I don't think the doctor needed to say that he was badly burned. It's such a great line, though. Ronnie and the doctor lament the pain that Artie must be in, but Mel is much more concerned with a potential uproar among the campers and wants to just put the whole incident behind them. Mel has a very Larry Vaughn thing going on without the car salesman charm during the first third of this film. He just wants to keep everything that's happening quiet so as not to upset anyone and bring any badness down on the camp itself. He quickly does some damage control in the form of promoting Ben to head chef, giving everyone that works in the kitchen a raise, and insisting that if anybody asks, they just say that Artie got another job someplace else. And then life goes on. We move on to one of the boys' cabins where a group of boys led by Ricky are hazing another boy called Mozart, who's lying on the floor with a rag over his eyes. Ricky goes through this whole spiel about how Mozart has to concentrate really hard on doing a single sit-up, but that he'll find he won't be able to do it. It's like this mind over matter thing. He counts down to three, and Mozart quickly sits up, planting his face square into the center of Paul's naked ass, which is both hilarious and fucking bizarre. And it's just one of the many little moments that add to the authenticity of the kids in this movie. Kids are weird, and they do weird shit, and this is a great example of that. Another superbly dressed male counselor. There's so many, like, cut-off belly shirts. It's like the perfect early 80s fashion time capsule. But that counselor comes in at the tail end of the gag, no pun intended, and laughs with everyone, then gathers them all together for a softball game. The ball game scene goes on for so long, and is rife with exquisite smack talk, and yet still more short shorts. It lasts for such a long time that I really start to forget what I'm watching. And you would think that would be a bad thing, but it really isn't. It just makes it feel more like a real camp with real kids. And it remains entertaining throughout. Next up, we move to the rec hall, where a bunch of kids of all ages are just milling about, huddled together in groups. It reminds me a lot of what dances were like in middle school. There's music playing somewhere in a corner, and it seems like the general idea was for people to dance, but nobody wants to admit they actually like dancing, so they just sit around and do nothing for 3 hours instead. One of the older boys, Kenny, is making rounds, trying to convince some of the girls to go skinny dipping with a bunch of the boys, but he seems to be striking out. Another boy suggests that they ask Angela, who's sitting alone in a corner, creepily eating a candy bar, calling back to her audition, just nailing it. So Kenny and his friend Mike go over and ask Angela if she wants to join them for a swim, to which she replies with just yet still more staring, and they start teasing her about that when Mel arrives, followed soon after by Ricky and Paul. And Ricky is wearing like a 10-gallon cowboy hat. I don't know where he got it, and it never comes back. It's just here for this one scene. Kenny asks Angela why she's so fucked up, and at that point, Ricky has noticed this and steps in. The giant hat is then knocked off of Ricky's head, and it's game on. Ricky tackles the boys, and soon there are like 12 boys in total wrestling in the middle of the room while Angela and basically everyone else just stands around watching. One of the counselors eventually does pull Ricky off of the rest of the boys who leave, and Mel just stands there with Meg and watches too. The counselor takes Ricky, whose nose is bleeding, to the infirmary, and Paul goes over to check on Angela. As a character, Paul makes me sad because he does seem like a relatively sweet and sincere boy who then just does really stupid, infuriating things later that make it very difficult for me to like him. He tells Angela that he's sorry about what happened to her family and explains the history that he has with Ricky. And Angela's just looking at him, but in a sweet way. And this does not sit well with Judy, who's sitting across the room watching them talk to each other. The counselor from earlier returns and tells the boys from bunk 19 that it's time to turn in. So Paul says goodnight, and Angela smiles and says goodnight back. It's the first line that we hear from her, and it is adorable. She seems so happy. And Paul is equally thrilled. He runs out of the rec hall just on top of the world, and Angela sits there smiling, which makes Judy even more unhappy. Now we're out at the lake with Mike and Kenny and their friends, and they are trying to convince a small handful of girls to get naked and go swimming with them. When the girls tell them to start without them, one boy gets pissed and angrily strips, and most of the guys do the same, and then they just head out into the water. So many pale boy butts. Mike and Kenny, however, the ones who were teasing Angela in the rec hall, are standing under a nearby canoe getting stoned, and they kind of meander over to the girls and ask if one of them wants a moonlit canoe ride. One thing leads to another, and Kenny ends up in the canoe with a girl named Leslie. Mike tells them to have a good trip, and Leslie says she doesn't like the way he said it, which is a cute line that's always been one of my favorites. While out on the water, the music starts to amp up, and Kenny starts teasing Leslie by rocking the canoe and warning her about water snakes. They inevitably tip over, and Leslie swims away. Kenny swims under the canoe so that he's up for air in this little, like, canoe dome that actually looks like a lot of fun, especially when he starts playing around with the echo that his voice is making. He starts to sing when someone pops up in the water right in front of him. We only see them from the back, but he recognizes them immediately. He says he thinks the rest of the boys will be very interested in seeing whoever this is. He doesn't go tell them, of course, because this mystery person promptly drowns him under the canoe, and the rest of the boys think he's playing another trick by not responding when they call him, so they just go back to their bunk. The next morning, a disgruntled lifeguard named Hal goes out to fish a bunch of furniture and junk out of the pool, and he's just so unhappy about it. He sees an overturned canoe nearby on the shore and, bitching the whole way, approaches it and rolls it over to reveal an already decomposing and seaweed-covered Kenny, whose body is now, ironically, home to a water snake. Decomposing Kenny was a bit of a painstaking affair for Ed French, from what I understand, and I've heard a lot of complaints about this particular effect over the years, but I don't know, there was never anything about it that seemed especially awful to me. I've seen way worse, you know, fake dead people. Like, it's fine. I think it's just, I mean, it gets the job done. The lifeguard starts wailing on his whistle, and more paramedics, this time accompanied by the police, arrive to take his body away. Mel, of course, insists that Kenny's death was an accident, and he talks this out with Frank the cop, played by Alan Breton, the man with the mustache. Remember him because he's important later. Frank says it does look like he drowned, but that there didn't seem to be any signs that he drowned naturally, like from hitting his head or something. Ronnie isn't convinced it was an accident either, but Mel is insistent to the point where I'm genuinely surprised Frank didn't immediately take Mel in for questioning. He is very insistent, increasingly high-strung. If I had been Frank, I feel like I would have suspected him of foul play. Next, we're with the girls from Angela's bunk, who are out playing volleyball on a teeny tiny court while Angela awkwardly sits and watches. Judy is on a roll here, not just because she's a good volleyball player, but because she's wearing a hot pink t-shirt with her name on it. And this was the moment, right here, where I knew I would love her forever. As a personal aside, a few years back, I wanted to go as Judy for Halloween, and I was hoping that I could find a prefab Judy shirt in this exact style. It's so simple. It's just like a fitted neon pink shirt with the word Judy on it in black font. It's like New Times Roman or something. I could not find a prefab version of this shirt anywhere. One of these days, I will put forth the effort to have a shirt like this one custom made, but I was disappointed that year that I couldn't find one. I have seen some really great Judy cosplay over the years, and most of the best of them rock this shirt. Paul shows up with a tennis racket in his hand and sits down next to Angela, who instantly smiles and the two start talking. Paul asks if she'll join him as his date for this movie they're showing at the rec hall, and Judy stops caring about volleyball and starts skull-fucking the two of them with her eyes. She then points out, kind of to the whole group, that it isn't fair that Angela gets to sit around and talk to boys while the rest of the girls have to play, which gets Meg's attention, and she chases Paul off. She then lays into Angela, telling her that if she isn't going to play with them, she can just sit there and do nothing, that she isn't a prima donna, and Angela shuts down, just goes back to staring and not talking. Susie tries to step in, but it's just kind of too late at that point. Angela has retreated back within herself. Later that night in the rec hall, the kids watch a movie, and when it lets out, Paul and Angela head outside holding hands. So that's progressed. Paul offers to walk Angela back to her bunk, and Judy is right behind them, psychotically staring at them while Ricky tries and fails to distract her. When Paul and Angela get back to the bunk, he pulls her around the side of the cabin and kisses her. This changes her demeanor completely, and he recognizes this and tells her that he hopes she isn't mad. She says she isn't, but turns to leave, and incapable of reading the room, Paul asks her for another kiss. She doesn't kiss him back, she just stands there and lets him kiss her and then awkwardly goes inside. As Paul is leaving, he's stopped by Judy, who cracks herself up with some hardcore flirting. Then we're back in the boys' bunk for more Mozart torment. They put shaving cream in his hand and tickle his nose with a sock until he smashes the cream into his own face. It's something I think I saw done at least 3 or 4 times in person when I was at camp. This apparently is the last straw for poor Mozart, who pulls a knife out from under some clothes on a nearby shelf and starts chasing Ricky with it. I don't know what Mozart's plan was. Was he actually going to stab Ricky if he caught up to him? I feel like we needed more of Mozart. I would like to know more about this boy. One of the counselors comes in and confiscates the knife, which he just puts it under some clothes on a different shelf right in front of them, so not exactly top-notch confiscation, but he took it away, and then he tells them to go to bed, which they do, but first they throw all of their pillows at Paul and pile on top of him. The next day, at least I think it's the next day, Paul goes to the waterfront where Angela is sitting on some bleachers watching everybody swim. Despite their uncomfortable encounter after the movie, when Paul covers her eyes and makes her guess who he is, she guesses Burt Reynolds, which is so cute, and it instantly dates the movie. Angela seems happy to see him. Judy shows up in a plunging neckline bathing suit that I really wish I owned to tease them, and Paul tells her to go away, which she does, but not for long. She goes and talks to Meg, who then marches over and starts laying into Angela about not swimming. I'm not really sure where Paul went at this point. I guess he got up and left. When Angela just stares back at her, Meg gets increasingly upset and just starts shouting at her, then grabs a hold of her and starts shaking her until Ronnie runs over and intervenes. He tells Meg he wants to see her later and orders her back to her post, although I will say we never see Meg suffer any consequences for her treatment of Angela. From her fellow counselors, that is. Afterward, the girls are back in the bunk, and Judy comes out of the shower to find Angela staring at her again. Judy laughs and reminds the whole bunk that Angela got Meg in trouble, to which Angela actually responds, saying that she didn't do anything. In one of my other favorite moments of the movie, Judy throws a pillow at her and tells her that she never does anything, then stomps back over and yanks the pillow out of her hand. She's like, "Give me that." Like, I fucking love Karen Fields. This amusing display, however, quickly turns down a darker path, as Judy then asks Angela why she never takes showers with the rest of the girls. She first accuses her of being gay, then decides that it's because she hasn't hit puberty yet, and she's embarrassed to be naked in front of them. Susie tries to calm Judy down, but she just keeps getting more and more vicious, delivering the most memorable line of the movie, where she calls her a real carpenter's dream. When she tells Susie to fuck off, Susie hauls off and slaps her, and then Judy runs away. Susie is appalled with herself, and Angela leaves to go find Ricky. Some of the boys are having a water balloon fight on top of their cabin, which, much like the whole canoe dome thing, looks like a lot of fun. That's one of the many things that I love about Sleepaway Camp. Because they cast actual kids and it's shot at an actual camp, it just feels fun sometimes. I mean, there are a lot of fucked up things happening in the interim, but I mean, these little forays into camp fun are just, they're nice. Angela approaches the cabin, and one of the boys hurls a water balloon at her, which knocks her down just as Ricky is coming out of his cabin next door. He runs over to the boys on the roof and proceeds to cuss them out, a frantically spirited performance from Tiersten. Paul shows up and goes to help Angela while Mel tries to restrain Ricky and punishes the boys by forbidding them from the canteen for a week. As I mentioned, I did go to summer camp as a kid, but I had no idea what canteen meant in this context, so I looked it up, and apparently the canteen is like a shop where campers can buy snacks and souvenirs. I feel a little silly for not knowing that, but I didn't. And for the longest time, I thought Mel was telling the boys they couldn't have water for a week. I was very confused by this. Paul and Ricky help Angela up while the boys, led by Billy, continue to tease them. Then we fade into Billy's bunk, where all the rest of the guys are leaving to play another ball game. Billy, however, stays behind to use the bathroom, or in his words, take a wicked dump, and we get what, for me, is the worst kill of the movie. Billy goes into a stall in the bathroom and sits down. He's got his short shorts around his ankles, and he's doing his thing when someone comes in and sticks a broom handle through the handles of the stall doors to keep them closed. They then go outside and rip open the screen of the window and empty an entire hive of bees into the bathroom. We don't ever actually see the killer or Billy directly, just the elements, and I do really enjoy that. The implications. I'm a fan of that style of filmmaking. I just can't believe Billy wouldn't have simply crawled out of the stall, because it's just a regular bathroom stall. There's plenty of room at the bottom of the door, between the other stalls. I mean, anyone would have dropped to the floor and crawled out in that moment, but he doesn't. He does finally bust the door down, but at that point, it's too late. We first see his hand lying limp on the floor with the magazine he was reading all rolled up beside it, and the camera pans very slowly over to crazy deep red welts all over his arm, and his face is just positively covered in bees. It is a really great looking effect overall. I just hate the kill. From here, we cut sharply to Mel, who is very upset and talking to Ronnie about how Camp Arawak is finished. Nobody's ever going to send their kids here again. Ronnie is trying to comfort him, but Mel is sort of slipping into the bell jar. He is convinced that there is a killer on the campgrounds, and for whatever reason, Billy's death specifically confirms what Mel has evidently suspected all along, which is that Ricky is the killer. And it does seem to come kind of out of nowhere, which I really enjoy. Mel is a refreshingly introspective character, given the caricature that he is, you know, the older, cigar-smoking, tough-talking camp director, who seems to have just kind of been in denial through most of this film about what's happening around the campgrounds. So for him to just suddenly jump from that to talking out loud about something that has apparently been on his mind this whole time, it feels both jarring and appropriate. It does make sense. Ricky does have a connection in one way or another to everyone who has thus far been injured that Mel has seen. Mel saw Ricky and Angela running away from the walk-in. He saw Ricky fighting with Kenny in the rec hall, and he was there when Ricky was cussing Billy out out after the incident with the water balloon. So it does make perfect sense that Mel would suspect him. It just really feels like it comes completely out of left field. While this is happening, Angela is standing outside of her cabin looking around for Paul, from whom we get a little POV fake out as he creeps up behind her and scares her. This is one of the most iconic shots of the movie, Angela turning around with a startled look on her face as a hand reaches out toward her. You'll see it used in most of the trailers and promotional materials for the film, and it's definitely one of my favorite shots. The two of them go down to the lake for a little makeout session, then Angela trips him so he'll chase her, which he does, and it's really sweet, and there's this kind of windswept romantic score happening. He catches up to her and they kiss some more on the beach, but then Paul... Oh, Paul. He starts trying to feel Angela up, which I suppose, you know, at that time with the evolution of their relationship as we've seen it play out, I can see why a teenage boy filled with hormones might think that this cute cat and mouse game they've been playing on the beach and all of the kissing, I can see how he would think that this is a window, but she stops him and he starts in pressuring her, insisting that he isn't doing anything while simultaneously unbuttoning her shirt against her protests, and she just completely shuts down again. This is one of the more emotionally disturbing moments in the movie, both in general and also because of what we know about Angela specifically and what she's going through. It also sucks because, as I mentioned earlier, he's been so kind to her. He's one of the only people that's been able to get her to open up at all. You want to like Paul, and in this moment, he makes it very difficult. As Angela is lying there on the beach being completely ignored by the boy who is now chewing on her neck, Angela has a flashback to when she and her brother were little kids, standing in the doorway of their dad's room in their pajamas, giggling as he lovingly caresses Lenny, who is his boyfriend or husband. I'm not entirely sure what their official relationship is, but it was the man from the lake at the beginning of the movie. And whatever it is, they are clearly in love. The music here, which for me is some of the most moving of the film, it starts as a soft, melancholic piano and slowly becomes a little distorted, off key as the memory shifts from that moment to a moment when the two kids are in their bedroom and little Peter is pointing a finger at Angela, who's just sort of smiling at him, and his finger gets gradually closer and closer to her as the camera spins around them and the music continues to grow more discordant. These flashbacks are very interesting to me, as first, the beds in both memories seem to be resting in the middle of otherwise pitch darkness, nothing around them at all, just beds. I've always really enjoyed that. I've read several interpretations of these memories, and a lot of people tend to feel confused by them, which makes sense to me, but I've always felt that they are exhibitions of Angela's earliest sexual memories, first of her father in bed with Lenny, and then of the kids in bed together. Of course, this moment changes dramatically when we get the full picture of Angela and of her backstory, but the foundation is the same. I've always felt that these moments are simple, unbiased reflections of Angela's development and understanding of sexuality in ways that are naturally present in a lot of children's lives. Angela snaps out of it and shoves Paul off of her, jumping up and running away. Paul calls out to her, but at this point it's no good and he just sits there in the sand looking upset. I like to think he's upset with himself, but his actions suggest otherwise. The next day, a couple of counselors gather some kids in the center of camp to play Capture the Flag, which, as another personal aside, is a game I never actually got to play as a kid. I've only ever played it in video games, and I'm a little upset about that. It seems like a really fun game, so fuck everyone responsible for organized sports and PE activities during my childhood. I feel like you robbed me. While the rest of the kids play Capture the Flag, Paul and Angela have a chat about the night before. Paul expresses confusion, and Angela admits that she just wasn't ready. Paul says he understands, but when he goes to put his arm around her, she asks him not to, and this makes him mad, so she leaves. The ever-vigilant Judy witnesses this and sees it as an opportunity, sauntering up in yet another award-winning side ponytail and telling Paul he needs to get over Angela. Meanwhile, Ricky runs after Angela, not realizing something is wrong, and asks her to help him capture the enemy flag by cutting through the woods. She agrees, and they split up to execute Ricky's brilliant plan. Nearby, Judy and Paul have moved from the field into said woods, and they're making out. And to Paul's credit, he does seem like he's having a less than awesome time, although he does keep kissing her because hormones, and when they pull apart, Angela is standing between them. When she runs away again, Paul chases after her, and Judy looks positively gleeful. Ricky emerges from the other side of the clearing and calls her a scumbag, to which she replies that he's just jealous. In another moment that I've always personally appreciated, Judy actually does look upset when Ricky leaves, and I have to wonder what Karen Fields was thinking in that moment. What was she putting into that look? She brought something to Judy here that that I've always really liked. Did she feel guilty about Angela for a second? Or was it Ricky that she felt badly about? Or did Judy actually like Paul? Her whole pursuit of Paul has felt like a power play up to this moment, but that expression suggests to me that she might have actually just genuinely been interested and has been jealous of Angela this entire time. Down at the waterfront sometime later, Paul, who had been swimming, comes out of the water and sits down next to Angela, who's sitting at her usual spot on the bleachers looking particularly glum. He apologizes for what happened a lot and asks her to give him another chance, but Judy shows up in another great bathing suit and tells Angela she must be forgiving since Paul called her a prude. Instead of denying it, Paul just leaves. Nearby, Ricky is making his way down to the water when Mel stops him and gives him some major league crazy eyes as he interrogates him in a very weird way, trying to feel out whether or not he's the killer, or more likely just trying to let him know that he knows he's the killer without coming right out and saying it. Ricky, of course, is oblivious. Back with Judy and Angela, Judy is teasing her extra hard and Meg shows up to pile on, escalating things by picking Angela up and carrying her to the dock. Angela is screaming and kicking and begging her not to throw her in, and Ricky sees this and goes to help her, but Mel stops him, physically restraining him, and accuses him of killing people. I love this scene in particular. In terms of cinematography, it is one of my favorites. We see Angela being carried to the water in the background while Ricky struggles to get away from Mel in the foreground, and it just looks great. Meg and Judy are having the time of their life as Angela screams and thrashes around now in the lake. Ricky breaks free from Mel when Ronnie arrives, and he and the lifeguard run to rescue her. Hal also calls Meg a peckerhead, which has always cracked me up. You don't hear men calling women peckerheads enough. Angela's coughing and sputtering, and Ricky takes her back to the bleachers where he holds her and tells her everything is going to be okay. He's sort of looking very intensely off into the distance, saying that he won't let them get away with what happened. Now, I don't remember who I thought the killer was the first time I saw this film. I just have no memory of that, but I don't think I ever actually thought it was Ricky. And for the most part, the film doesn't try too hard to actually hammer it into your head that Ricky might be the killer. Most of our suspicion of Ricky, if any, exists through Mel. And because it's introduced so late in the film, it's just, he's not an effective red herring. But right here, this moment at the waterfront is one of the few where you can really tell that the intention was to create in Ricky a red herring. That night, the counselors get together for a meeting, and Ronnie tells Counselor Eddie that he has a big plan for him, which turns out to be taking a group of very young campers into the woods for a camping trip. Jerry and Meg get the night off, and Meg clearly intends to use hers to the weirdest advantage by immediately going to Mel and asking him to have dinner with her. Now, I'm not ageist. The groin once, but the groin once, but like, it's such a weird pairing. It creates an odd image in the mind, is what I'm saying. Excited at the prospect of being covered in cigar smell for the rest of her life, Meg goes bounding happily into the girls' cabin for a shower, but the line for the showers is really long, so she goes to the cabin next door. Once in the shower, Meg starts humming to herself, and it's hilarious because it isn't actually a song so much as it's just staccato throat noises, and it doesn't take long for it to be interrupted by a knife in her back. The knife is shoved through the thin shower wall and dragged all the way down her spine. One of the many things I love most about low-budget horror movies are the inventive ways that filmmakers use the environment and cinematography to imply brutal violence without showing it. And I've mentioned it a couple of times here thus far, but Sleepaway Camp specifically does this quite well. The shower kill is a great example of that. And unlike the bee thing, I buy this. It makes sense. The walls of the cabin showers are very thin. Meg is not expecting it. The second she is stabbed, she can't move. And the blood spurting out from the crack that the knife makes in the wall is a nice touch. She slumps down in the shower, and the killer uses the still running water to clean their knife before shutting it off. We peek in on Eddie and the littlest campers as they make their way into the woods for their even campier than summer camp actual camping trip. Eddie is not happy to be there, and he's not very nice to the kids. Back at the main camp, Angela is coming out of the rec hall as Paul is going in, and she stops to ask him where Ricky is. He tells her he's lying down because he doesn't feel well, then apologizes again. After a few long seconds, she tells him to meet her at the waterfront after the social. She leaves, and Paul seems happy. Back with the little kids at the campier camp, one of the boys tells Eddie he's cold and wants to go back, after which a second kid chimes in and Eddie agrees to drive them back to the campgrounds. He leaves the rest of the kids there to sleep because he's bad at his job. Then we get a POV of the kids and we know what's coming. Back at the start, when I mentioned a notable exception to a sense of justice, one might say, regarding the kills in this movie, this is the exception to that rule. Hiltzik himself has said that this kill, or these kills, I should say, are the only thing that's never really sat right with him about the film, and he's always regretted keeping them in. And it's true. It's the one act in the movie that unquestionably paints the killer in an unsympathetic light, and it doesn't even make any sense for the kids to be killed. I mean, apart from perhaps in the mind of a killer sparing them from any future suffering, or possibly sparing the world from any suffering that they may inflict as they get older, and that's a fucking stretch. It doesn't fit, but it happens. These poor little kids are slaughtered in their sleeping bags. We don't see it happen, just the aftermath. Before Eddie returns and finds them dead, we pop back to the rec hall where Mel is asking around about Meg, who never showed up for their dinner date. Meanwhile, Judy is back at the girls' cabin, aggressively making out with Mike, and she's irritated because apparently Mike is a wet kisser. They start kissing again and hear a noise, so she tells him to get under the bed and pretends to be reading in the dark. Mel comes in looking for Meg, and Judy tells him that she went next door after dinner. He makes a comment about her reading in the dark before he leaves that I've always appreciated. And once he's gone, Mike pops back up and puts his shoes on, saying he's leaving because he doesn't want to get caught, and Judy yells at him because she's a sex bully. After he leaves, she does this angry pouting thing with her pillow, and it's amazing. Next door, Mel is looking for Meg and inevitably finds her body in the shower, which by some miracle of physics was propped up against the shower curtain and drops down in front of him right as he walks in. And it's ridiculous, but it's immediately countered by the knife lying down her back and just her makeup in general. It's beautiful craftsmanship. Mel delivers this mortified reaction and monologue that is forever burned in my brain as one of the best I have ever seen, honestly. If you watch Sleepaway Camp for no other reason, which, I mean, if you're listening to this, hopefully you've already seen it, but if you haven't and you watch this movie for no other reason, watch it for Mel's reaction to Meg's death. It is legendary. Then we're back at the girls' cabin where Judy is curling her hair, again, in the dark. She hears footsteps outside and thinks it's Mike coming back, but it isn't. The door opens and we see what has become one of the more infamous moments in the movie, thanks to high def. What we're supposed to be seeing is the killer's silhouette in the doorway. But because Jonathan Tiersten played the killer during a lot of these violent scenes, which, because I've decided to do this deep dive without revealing who the killer is directly, I just realized how difficult it is to talk about this moment, but it's not supposed to be Jonathan Tiersten standing in the doorway. And while this scene was presumably well lit for film in 1983, it was not meant to be seen with present day technology. We can straight up see it is Jonathan Tiersten in a wig. Of course, Judy can't see this and she asks who it is. When they don't answer, she tells whoever it is to keep the light off so they don't have to go to the social, and we get a POV moving toward Judy's bed. Once the killer is close enough, Judy recognizes them and starts to be nasty, but is quickly silenced by a good old fashioned fist to the face. She's lying there in the bed, still conscious but dazed and crying, and the killer lifts her legs onto the bed, puts a pillow over her face, grabs the curling iron, and shoves it up Judy's vagina. That's right, Judy dies in part by way of a curling iron to the baby box. We don't see it head on, of course, but we do see it play out on the wall in shadow, and it's fucked up, and I love it. One of my favorite kills from any horror film, hands down. Apparently, they did film the aftermath. There was a shot of Judy's corpse, but they had to remove it as the MPAA thought it was too gruesome, and that does not surprise me. The killer pulls Judy's bed out from the wall, shoves her body to the floor, then puts the bed back and leaves the cabin. Meanwhile, Eddie discovers the dead kids at the campsite. He throws up at the sight of them and runs back to Camp Arawak calling for help. And this is when we see the sleeping bags all mauled. Ricky is up and headed to the rec hall when a counselor, Jeff, stops him and tells him the social is over. He needs to get back to his bunk. Ricky convinces him to let him grab something from the kitchen, and he comes out with a handful of candy bars. He's making his way back when the phone rings at Ronnie's cabin, and we hear a muffled conversation from a distance between him and someone I assume is either Eddie or the police, calling about the kids that were with Eddie. While this is happening, Mel grabs Ricky and drags him into the woods. Ricky's calling for help, but Mel is completely unhinged, screaming about the murders, and starts smacking the shit out of him. Ricky insists he doesn't know what he's talking about, but he starts starts beating him with both hands, calling him a liar until Ricky isn't screaming or moving anymore. Mel is fiendishly talking to Meg in his mind when he hears a twig snap nearby and looks up. He runs away and winds up disorientedly standing in front of an archery target, then sees someone in front of him and says, "It can't be you." We see a shot of the killer's arm twirling an arrow in their hand as Mel continues to insist that it can't be whoever it is. Then he is shot through the neck with an arrow in a very cool effect that I have always felt Ed French should be super proud of. We cut to a police car, lights flashing, pulling up to the camp, and out steps Frank the cop. Remember him? Alan Breton, Frank the cop, with a brand new and painfully fake mustache. Alan Breton had shaved his real mustache off for a role in another job between scenes, and rather than just let his upper lip be naked, Hiltzik insisted on the use of a fake that doesn't even remotely match Breton's actual hair or the mustache he had at the start of the film. And to make matters more hilarious, we get a superb close-up shot of it just to hammer it home. Again, this is something else that may not have looked as bad in 1983, but now it just looks like somebody collaged a thick strip of brown felt to the middle of Breton's face. I fucking love it. I love Frank's mustache. It is spectacular. Susie shows up to where Frank and Ronnie are talking and tells them that Angela and Judy are missing. Another counselor, whose name I can't remember, also arrives to say that Paul and Ricky are gone. Frank tells the counselors to break off into pairs and search the grounds. Out at the water, Paul is waiting for Angela, who shows up with her hair looking all kinds of crazy. She's got like twigs in it. Her eyes are popping even more out of their head than they normally do. She looks rough. And she tells Paul she wants to go swimming. When Paul asks about their clothes, she tells him to take them off, and he gets super happy, and Angela starts taking her shirt off with her back to him. Back with Frank, he and one of the counselors are searching the woods with a flashlight when Frank spots a candy wrapper on the ground and shortly thereafter finds Ricky, who, as it turns out, isn't dead, just very badly beaten and regaining consciousness. They carry him out of the woods and hear screaming coming from one of the cabins. One of the counselors has found Meg. This is when we get that money shot of Frank's mustache as he comes out of the cabin. Ronnie and Susie make their way through the campgrounds, and Ronnie stops for a second, saying he hears singing coming from the waterfront. They make their way down to the lake to find Angela, mostly naked, sitting on the ground with a completely naked Paul lying in her lap. She's caressing his hair and singing softly to herself. Susie recognizes her and calls out to her, but she doesn't turn around right away. As they move closer, we get another flashback of the day Angela went to live with Aunt Martha. We see a small child, head wrapped in bandages, looking down at the ground as Martha insists that Angela will love living with her. As the camera pans around, she further reveals that she already has a little boy, meaning Ricky, so she doesn't need another one of those, and that a girl would be much nicer. It's at this moment that we, the audience, realize it wasn't Angela who survived the boating accident at the beginning of the film, but rather Angela's little brother, Peter, who Martha raised as a little girl, calling him by his sister's name. We cut back to the present-day waterfront, where Angela stands up and whirls around, Paul's head, which turns out to have been severed from his body, falling from her lap as she stands there, naked and snarling, almost feral, and we can clearly see she has a penis. Two things about this scene. Firstly, this isn't actually Felissa Rose in this moment, but a man in a Felissa Rose mask, and this effect has become less and less realistic over the years, to the point where it's almost impossible to believe now, but that doesn't make the reveal any less shocking or emotionally devastating. I love Sleepaway Camp so much. I have never understood why they chose to make Angela growl and snarl like a wild animal. It just doesn't really seem to check with everything else we've been shown, everything we've been told in this film. We feel for Angela. Our hearts go out to her, especially in these final moments with that final flashback. So many pieces are falling into place for us. Aunt Martha's protective treatment of Angela, the flashbacks we saw earlier in the film, why she didn't want to swim or shower with the other kids. There are so many pieces falling into place here, and all of them wrench at your heartstrings. But the growling and the snarling is contradictory and fucking weird. The camera freezes on Angela's face and fades to a negative image as the credits roll. The song played here, called simply Angela's Theme, or You're Just What I've Been Looking For, was written and performed by Frank Vinci, and I love it, especially when one considers that it's much more of a solemn song than a violent one, which I think is very fitting for the character of Angela Baker. So that's it. That's Sleepaway Camp. The film saw mixed reviews upon initial release, becoming increasingly popular over the years, franchise and is now widely celebrated as a cult hit. There are 6 films in the Sleepaway Camp franchise, and I do enjoy a couple of the others, but the first film will always be my favorite for its charm and the impression it made on me as a budding teenage horror fanatic. It has one of my favorite casts from the 1980s, and definitely, as I said earlier, one of my favorite scores. Also, I have to reiterate, it is so much more than just a shocking ending. It's a surprisingly authentic teen slasher with what I've always interpreted as a kind heart compared to so many of the other horror movies like it out there. To go back to what I was saying regarding transgender representation, if you haven't seen it, I do recommend watching episode 54 of the Dead Meat podcast, Transgender Representation in Horror. And in that podcast, they will also recommend episode number 48 of How Did This Get Made, the Sleepaway Camp episode, which I also highly encourage everyone to check out. After Dark Analysis also released a video entitled Transgender Representation in the Sleepaway Camp franchise, which looks at Sleepaway Camps 1 through 3. And one of my personal favorite articles about the first Sleepaway Camp was written by Harmony M. Colangelo, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, from Medium.com, entitled The Transgender Defense of Angela Baker and Sleepaway Camp. Those are just some of the things that I have watched and read that directly address inherent implications for the transgender community present in Sleepaway Camp and its sequels. I can only see this film through my own eyes. And for me, watching Sleepaway Camp is oftentimes a cathartic experience. I was bullied hard in elementary and middle school, usually by other girls, and struggled constantly to come to terms with things like jealousy, competitive girls, mean girls, not to mention sex and sexuality and the thousands of obstacles they present to someone going through puberty. And Sleepaway Camp has, as I said when we started, always felt to me to be an advocate, providing its audience with realistic depictions of adolescence and the myriad dangers young people face. If nothing else, it serves as an undeniable reminder that we all have gone through things like this. And while Angela's story is one that certainly goes to extremes, and we probably shouldn't go around stabbing the assholes we encounter in life, it is perfectly normal to be affected by them. Thanks so much for listening, guys. I don't have much of a wrap-up this week, except to say that I am so relieved to finally be back at the mic and feeling a little better. If you are a patron or a member of the Discord, you may have seen the announcement I made regarding some new content for the Patreon. Starting in July, I'll be recording a couple of full film commentary tracks, mostly as an experiment. If you guys like them, I imagine I'll do them more often. I'm looking forward to it. It's a totally new thing for me, and I feel like it could be a lot of fun. I hope it will be, anyway. If you're new to Final Girl Friday and you don't hate it, or if you would just like to tell me what your thoughts are on Sleepaway Camp, I would love to hear them. Please feel free to join me on Discord. You can find an open invitation to my server in the description of this podcast on Anchor. You can also find me on Slasher. My username is Final Girl Friday, or on Instagram as Molly Oblivion. I am on Twitter too, but I'm fucking trash at remembering to use it. So yeah, I wouldn't bother following me there unless you enjoy the sweet sounds of absolute silence. Be good to each other, guys, and thanks again for putting up with the wide range of emotions I've been displaying all over the internet these last couple of weeks. Things are finally starting to calm down in my head, which feels nice. And I hope more than anything that the days ahead are easier, happier. I know how hard it is to stay positive right now, but I think we can do it. I think that we can affect change and make the world a better place while maintaining our sanity at the same time. I'll see you next week for 28 Days Later. And until then, creep it real.